Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
Claudia Hoag, Midwest Genealogy Center, on Saturday, September 22nd at 11 a.m., interviewing Daniel Karp.
There. Yes, ma'am.
Now, do you want me to ask you questions? Or
whatever way you would like to format it.
No, this is up to you.
Well, I think that would go well.
Excellent. So, I see that you have on your Korean War veteran.
Right.
And so I'm guessing you were in the Korean War. Did you make a career out of the military?
Yes, ma'am.
So, what would you like to tell me?
Well,
where would you like to begin?
Well, we can begin. I enlisted in the Air Force in November 1948. And I was at Lackland Air Force Base for basic training. I wanted to be a cadet and fly, but I flunked the physical. I had broken my nose playing ball earlier. And so I went instead to OCS. Perhaps it would be worthwhile to explain that I made a Division I college basketball team in 1948. But what had happened, I started college in 1947. In January, and I was drafted by a fraternity which I couldn't afford to join because we were too poor to play intramural basketball, and we won the intramural championship. So the freshman coach said, "Come out for basketball in September 19." So I came out and I made the Division I team, 40,000 kids in the school, and the day before the first game, when they gave out the uniforms, the coach comes to me and said, "Your grades in the spring semester were not high enough for you to be allowed to play." So I was so embarrassed that I joined the Air Force the next day. So then I go down to Lackland Air Force Base after Thanksgiving, 1948, and we're playing basketball while we're having, basic training, and we end up finishing second out of, I don't know how many, more than 40,000 people there at that time. We lost to the African-American team. In those days, it was segregated. And so comes January, we're still playing basketball, as an intramural sport. And a guy comes out, and he kicks the first ball, and he fumbles the second one. And I come up to him, and I pat him, and I say, "Listen, we give everybody a chance. We want you to, we need players." Next thing I know, I get called to the orderly room. And the captain says, the lieutenant, that's the guy I'm patting, says, "You're a leader. Go to OCS. I said, "No, I want to fly." And as I told you, I flunked the physical. So I come back and I say, "I want to go to OCS. He says, "Go take the test." I said, "I just took the test." "No, you got to go take the test again." So I take the test again. Well, when I took the test the first time, I'm a New York kid from Brooklyn. And they got this thing about the clutch and the gears and how do you park a car on the side of a road, and I don't have the slightest idea. And I'm talking to the boys in the barracks and they're all laughing at me. So I go back and take the test again and get 99. So I get to go to OCS in July of 1949. I'm the youngest guy in the entire class of over 350 guys, and I'm in trouble. I'm a slob. And lo and behold, the commandant decides that he's going to have a basketball team. And I'm the point guard, and we're playing all the small colleges in Texas while we're in OCS, and I never get another demerit. Comes graduation.
Tell them what the things you did wrong.
Oh, I couldn't bounce that quarter off the bed like you're supposed to, and I'm walking tours. But anyway.
So they forgave him for all this stuff because he was on the team. You follow me?
Anyway, when graduation comes, I'm the only one that can't stand up and take the oath because I'm not 21 years old. So I wait until I'm 21 years old, I'm typing in the orderly room, and I go off on leave and I come back and I report to another squadron still at Lackland Air Force Base. So in effect what you did, you went through basic, you learned things, you went through OCS, you learned it all over again, then they assigned you as a TAC officer, you learned it all over again. And I report to this guy, Fulmer Smith, ended up a general. He says to me, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I got these orders." He says, "Well, I've got all these jobs filled. What can you do?" So I say to him, "I can coach anything." And so I end up being the only athletic officer on this base of 40,000 with no duties. So I'm walking around, there's hundreds of guys taking PT, and I'm saying, "Oh, veteran salute, where did you play?" "Oh yeah, 4 o'clock, meet me." And we win anything. Anyway, they send me down to Keesley Air Force Base, and I very quickly flunk out of radar school. So then they make me into a supply officer. And I eventually end up in Shia, Japan with Troop Carrier. And I'm a supply officer there. And I'm bored to tears. So I volunteer to be an assistant prosecutor. Because on the base, we only had two certified officers. And one of them was the staff judge advocate, and the other had to be the defense, because the court-martial manual says that the defense must be at least as well or better qualified than the prosecutor. So therefore they make me the prosecutor. And I'm prosecuting all these special court-martials. And then they send me down to Kokura, Japan to take testimony for a general court-martial where somebody's been robbing the motor pool blind. And I screw up taking the deposition because I don't know enough not to ask the same question twice. That was the end of my career as a legal officer. And from there, I was assigned to Cambridge Research Center in Massachusetts. And in June of 1954, I got married to my first wife, Shaney Carver. And we were there until 1955. I went down to the Squadron Officer School, and my whole life changed. I got so turned on by this school, and I was a distinguished graduate, and I was asked to stay on the faculty, and my wife joined me. At that time, we had one son, was born because I got married in June of 1954, and he was born in April 1955, and I was on the Squadron Officer School faculty, where we were 72 sections. And I was a section commander, and I had a great record there, I'm very proud to say, including finished first and in the top seven three or four times. And so, including winning what they call the commander's trophy, chief of staff's trophy. So anyway, from there I'm sent When I joined the faculty of Squadron Officer School, they told us we could go anywhere we wanted when we left, because it was a very tough assignment. So my wife picks Terrejón, Spain, Aviano, Italy, and Wiesbaden, Germany. We get Elmendorf, Alaska. So at that point, I have two children. I have one born in 1955, one born in 1956. So we come in a C-54, a DC-6, comes into Elmendorf, and in those days, you used to have to bring the ladder up to the airplanes. And down at the bottom of the ladder are two blue staff cars, and a couple gets out of each staff car. My wife comes down the ladder, the two women grab her and start hugging and kissing. It's the division commander and the group commander, and I'm a captain. And they by-named me. They had a problem in Elmendorf. And the problem was in the base supply. And, you know, that was my... I was a base supply officer, didn't know anything about supply. So I sort of... Well, when we were alerted that we had this assignment, we got a letter from a sponsor who said it was 11 months to get base housing, and you had to live on the economy, and the allowance stunk. Well, 4 days after we got there, we moved into quarters, painted to my wife's specifications. So you see, I always had a hard time. So anyway, I had to go back and testify before the Civil Service Commission in Washington and all kinds of stuff. So from Elmendorf in 1962, I was selected for major and go back to Maxwell Air Force Base to attend the Air Command and Staff College. I finished second in the class in the Staff College, and the joke I make, Colin Powell, he also finished second, and look what happened to him. Anyway, so I was assigned to stay again on the faculty. And then a strange thing has happened back when I was at the Squadron Officer School. The school had a policy that nobody could have a position except the general officer unless they taught one 14-week class as a buck instructor. And in 1958, when my section finished first, they formed an additional group, and they manipulated it so that as a captain, I was the deputy commander for 14 weeks of a group. And a guy graduates from the Air War College, full colonel by the name of Herb Bench, and he gets assigned to that group, and I'm his mentor. I'm a captain, he's a colonel, I'm his mentor. Now we jump forward to 1967. I get a phone call from a young man who had been one of my students, named Marcotte. He says, General Bench wants to talk to you. And he says, Dan, the Air Force is going to build two bases in Vietnam without the Corps of Engineers and without the Seabees, with this brand new outfit called Red Horse. As a matter of interest, Red Horse is still in existence. And this was to prove that the Air Force was truly mobile. We didn't even need support. So he wanted me to go to Tuiwa, but I couldn't get there because the class wasn't over. So they assigned me to Phu Cat. And Phu Cat was halfway between Cameron Bay and Da Nang, and 26 miles in from the port of Quy Nhon. And we come in tents, and we build air-conditioned buildings. And these were the days in Vietnam when the Army could not even build a hooch. And we're building air-conditioned buildings and air-conditioned quarters. I had a $56 million construction budget on top of my operating budget. And it was very, very interesting. We got, I'm not a combat soldier. The closest thing I ever came to was during the Tet Offensive I had just come back from Saigon on Monday morning, and Tet occurred, I think, Monday night or Tuesday night, and they mortared us. And I had a 40,000-pound bladder up on the flight line for additional refueling, because we really didn't have enough trucks to refuel 100 fighters. So we also had this big bladder, which like a gas station, really, and they would bring the planes up to the bladder. Well, they put some holes in this bladder, which was made of rubberized canvas, I guess, or something. And this goes back, I think, before your time, in the days when cars had tube tires, had tubes, and any time you got a flat, you had to take out this little red stuff with this funny smelling glue that the kids, I think, still sniff, and used to patch it. Well, we got these great big patches, and we're putting up, and my boss and I went up, and it must have been 1-2 o'clock in the morning when we got the phone call. With the mortars and all this stuff. So we went up and we're helping. We're all covered with kerosene, and I'm saying, no smoking, no smoking. that's my one moment of real danger in the military. So when I came back from Vietnam, I was assigned as Chief of Supply of the 21st Air Force at McGuire Air Force Base. And my first wife said, you're going to retire. And I said, why should I retire? I had been the 16th youngest lieutenant colonel in the whole Air Force. I mean, I had all kinds of breaks and all kinds of good things happening for me. And she says, if you don't, I'm going to leave you and take the kids. So I retired and I began a career in civilian life. Now, do you want to go on into this? This is the end of the military.
It's up to you. If you would like to share.
Well, I'll just give you a quick rundown. First job I got, we formed a computer company called Heuristic Concepts. And we had some tremendous ideas. Matter of fact, in my mind, we could have been Microsoft, except for one thing. We didn't have a single businessman in the company. Everybody was technical. And my goal part was, what would you like the computer to do as a user? Because if you look back, this is 1968, and computers are just breaking into the world. They hit finance first, and then logistics is a very logical thing. So in this company, we built a digital data recorder, and we had a mock-up of a digital cash register. And if you know, the digital cash register was the most significant thing that ever happened in retail in the United States, because for the first time, the small business owner knew that in addition to having $2 million of inventory, he had 42 pairs of shoes and 9 blouses, and because he never knew that. It was always wrong. And every time they used to take inventory once a year, it was a joke. So the digital cash register, which removed the object from inventory and added the object to inventory, as well as the money, changed and cut capital employed maybe 30 or 40%, which was dramatic. Every store now knows what they have, or at least they think they do. So from when we went bankrupt with Heuristic Concepts, in probably about 1971 or 72, I got a job as director of distribution for Gallo Wine in New York. They covered the 5 boroughs of New York and some of the outside counties. Hated the job. And I eventually ended up with a company called StoneCo, which was a manufacturer of outdoor lighting fixtures. I joined the company, it was $3.5 million. We built it up to 26. It was part of a Keen Corporation. And from there, well, I was president of the Northern New Jersey chapter of the American Production and Inventory Control Society. It was an organization of about 40,000 people. We had about 1,500. And one of the things we used to do was post-job opportunities. And Revlon came in with a request for a senior group director of material management. And I talked about it before one of the meetings. Nobody replied. I talked about it at a second meeting. And then some circumstances occurred at Keen Lighting. And so I took the job with Gallo. And that was quite a jump. I got into six-figure business. And I was with Revlon.
That's right.
And I was with Revlon until Perlman made an unfriendly takeover of Revlon. That's somewhere in the early 1980s. And I got fired 9 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock, my boss calls me. He was vice president of material, Revlon US. And he says, guess what? I said, you got fired. And he says, and George got fired. And George was vice president operations, Revlon World. So we all got blown out the same day. I went to work for Caswell Massey. At the same time, my first wife passed away from pancreatic cancer. And I'm working for Caswell Massey, and somebody calls me and says, I just got an additional, he was running a factory here in Kansas City. He says, I just got an additional job to run a place in Houston. Would you like to run it for me? So I went down to Houston. I looked at it. It was a fluorescent factory. I said, okay. And I go back to New York, and I'm in the Caswell Massey office like 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. Phone rings. And he says, did you resign? I said, no, I'm writing a letter. Oh, stop. We just got acquired by,
the Gen guy. Light. Was it Gen Light?
No. We got acquired by a company in England, which I'll think of for 15.
Oh, yeah.
15.
I should know that.
Yeah.
Too.
$15 billion. It was a very big company. It was part of Kidder Corporation. And says, don't resign. And then he calls me back in January and says, well, they just took my director of operations here in Kansas City. Would you like to come in? So I came to Kansas City. And we did the leverage buyout. We bought the company from the people, Hanson PLC.
That's right.
Of London.
Right, Hanson Trust.
So we bought that company. And we didn't make it. We did a leverage buyout. But after a couple of years, we went bankrupt. But before we did that, I retired when I was 65. And subsequently, well, all through this latter portion, I was United States Tennis Association umpire. I was a national line and a regional chair. And my greatest point of fame was I was on the center line during Steffi Graf's first win in America at the, I can't remember the name of the tournament. But anyway, it was on public television. And I made a call on the center line. And Bud Collins said, I agree with Dan Karp's call. Now, I don't know that. I come home and my kids call, Dad, we saw you on national television. You made the right call. So that was my moment of glory. And so, I did that. At the same time, I became a docent. When I was 70 years old, I became a docent at the Nelson Atkins Museum. And when I was 88, I had to retire from that because I couldn't walk anymore. So here we are. I'll be 90 in December. Oh, I forgot about Rosemary. When did we get married? What year?
We got married in 95.
Okay, 1995 in January, we got married.
We had met when you first came to Kansas City, which was...
Yeah.
When was that? 1988?
1988. Memorial Day 1988 on a blind tennis date.
Blind date.
But what happened was we didn't get married because I had sold a house and they had this provision that if you're over 55, you didn't have to pay taxes unless it was $1 million. And she was like 49 or something like that.
Yeah. So we had to wait till I was 55 to sell my house for the one-time exclusion. So we didn't get married because of tax purposes until 95.
Yeah, because it didn't seem...
Yeah, because it was a, you know...
And none of the kids minded that we lived in Sid. So now we have five kids.
Between us.
Yeah, we have nine because we had one divorce. And then we have 10 grandchildren, and now we have two great-grandchildren. So three of our children are married, and one who's not married has a baby and lives with his...
grandson. Significant other.
With his significant other. So this is the modern world. So we think we're pretty liberal-minded people about everything, and we just, we're looking forward to my 90th birthday. We're going to have everybody come, including even girlfriends of some of the other grandchildren.
Yeah, significant others are invited.
Yeah.
And we're moving from our large house right now at Weatherby Lake to an apartment that we will own.
Yeah, co-op.
And it won't be completed until we figure close to November.
Right,
and
November
we'll be moving 15. In mid-November.
Right.
So we're downsizing. We're in the process of downsizing from 3,000 square feet to
1,550 square feet.
Yeah.
We've had a great life. We had a great life.
Yeah, we played a lot of tennis that tennis court.
Yeah, we have our own tennis court with 6,000 watts of lights on it. And it's an extraordinary tennis court. Henry Block comes up to me one day and says, Dan, you should see what they did to my tennis court. They put in 3 inches of pumice, 2 inches of blacktop, and then they laid the court. Now, Henry's about 93, 94 now. He's very frail. It's so great for the knees. So I said, Henry, how much did it cost? I don't know. Somebody pays all his bills.
Well, he doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
So why should he even bother?
So he says McConnell and Associates did the court. So I call McConnell. They had resurfaced my court for $3,000 sometime before. $23,000. So we took a second mortgage. And then we raised our lighting to 6,000 watts. It's lighter than daytime. And every weekend we would have a tennis party. We'd have three other couples. We would play, and then the women would
play
get together.
We would drink.
We have singles
and doubles, mixed doubles, you name it. Men's doubles, women's doubles.
And we have a gazebo in the back of the court where you can sit up to 12 people, and you can kibitz and, you know, pester the players. And, we had so much fun.
But we used the court
so
often, and then during the week we'd have
we play during the week.
Groups come and play.
Eventually, we're both retired. But I stopped playing about seven or eight years ago.
And I just stopped playing in January. I had stem cell injections.
Yeah.
And hopefully, we'll see.
Yeah.
It's supposed to take about a year before you can really see a huge difference.
Now you know everything about us.
So, I may return to play.
I hope so.
Well,